of Rio Salado College. For more information, visit sunsounds.org.
It's time now for the reading of the Thursday, August 8th issue of The Wall Street Journal. Our reader today, Dr. Dick Lovins.
And good morning to you all, and I hope you're doing well today. We're in the usual place, which, of course, is the front page, and the column called What's News, Business and Finance. And here we go, a flight to safety that drove down bond yields globally amid fears about the U.S.-China dispute sparked renewed volatility in stocks, which fell sharply before largely recovering by the close. Gold prices topped $1,500 a troy ounce for the first time in 6 years, A1B1. That's where there are further articles on this subject. Central banks in India, New Zealand, and Thailand cut rates aggressively as fallout from the U.S.-China trade war intensified. The White House is expected to start implementing provisions of a law banning the government from doing business with Huawei. FedEx said it was ending its contract to deliver packages from online shopping giant Amazon through its ground network. Broadcom is nearing a deal to buy Symantec's enterprise business after its bid to purchase the entire cybersecurity firm fell apart. Lyft boosted its outlook for the year as the company gained more riders and amid new signs that a price war with Uber is abating. SoftBank's plans for a second tech mega fund focused on A1 startups is poised to flood an already hyped sector with more cash. CVS posted a second straight quarter of strong results, with Aetna driving much of the gains. Fox Corporation said it will continue to look for acquisitions as results beat estimates. AIG recorded a nearly 18% increase in second quarter net income. Now we drop down to the worldwide section of the same column, and here we go again. The president met with victims of mass shootings in Ohio and Texas, but his plans were punctuated by fights with Democrats, angered by his rhetoric and skeptical of his pledge to tackle gun violence. Walmart's chief executive said he was rethinking the company's role in confronting gun violence. Retail tycoon Wexner said that his former money manager, Jeffrey Epstein, misappropriated more than $46 million of his fortune. A Chinese official warned that Beijing would intervene if Hong Kong proved unable to contain violent protests. Puerto Rico Justice Secretary Wanda Vasquez was sworn in as governor after a court ruling against Rosello's chosen successor. The House Judiciary Panel filed a lawsuit in a bid to force ex-White House counsel McGahn to testify. Immigration officials raided Mississippi food processing plants, detaining 680 people suspected of being in the U.S. illegally. Suspected Iranian hackers infiltrated critical infrastructure and government computers in Bahrain within the past month. Separatists in Yemen tried without success to seize the presidential palace in the southern city of Aden. The UK government launched a charm offensive this week in a bid to secure a trade deal with the US quickly after Brexit. Okay. Let's turn the page. And we're on the back page, the back side of the front page, called U.S. News. The subheadline is U.S. to expand Huawei restrictions. And here we go. The White House is expected to start implementing provisions of a law that bars the U.S. government from doing business with Huawei Technologies Company, moving ahead despite the Chinese telecommunication giant's efforts to block the rule in court. The Office of Management and Budget issued an interim rule this week, laying out steps to ensure that U.S. government agencies aren't doing business with Huawei and several other Chinese companies. The rule, posted Wednesday on a General Services Administration website, is set to go into effect August 13th. The administration then has another year to comply with a separate, more restrictive provision that would bar the government from contracting with any company that uses products or services from Huawei or the other banned companies, a senior administration official said. The administration has a strong commitment to defending our nation from foreign adversaries and will fully comply with Congress on the implementation of the prohibition of Chinese telecom and video surveillance equipment, including Huawei equipment, unquote, OMB spokesman Jacob Wood said. Huawei said the news was, quote, unquote, not unexpected, and it would continue to, quote, challenge the constitutionality of the ban in federal court, unquote. The U.S. action implements a portion of the National Defense Authorization Act, which President Trump signed last year. The defense policy law contains provisions targeting Huawei and other Chinese tech companies that U.S. officials consider a security risk. The provisions ban U.S. agencies and recipients of federal grants and loans from doing business with the Chinese companies or contractors that make substantial use of their products. The restrictions also target Huawei rival ZTE Corporation and surveillance equipment maker Hangzhou Hikvision Digital Technology Company. Huawei is challenging the NDAA provisions with a lawsuit filed in March in Texas Federal District Court. The lawsuit said that the rules are an unconstitutional, quote, bill of attainder, unquote, or an action that finds a person or entity guilty of a crime via an act of legislation. The U.S. has responded that it has ample national security reasons for enacting the law. Individual agencies will have some ability to grant waivers. The Director of National Intelligence can also grant waivers when they are deemed to be within national security interests, the official said. The restrictions in the NDAA are separate from the Trump administration's May announcement placing Huawei on a trade blacklist, preventing companies from supplying it with U.S.-sourced technology without licenses. That blacklisting is being administered by the Commerce Department, which is weighing applications for such licenses for U.S. companies whose technology shipments to Huawei don't threaten national security. The moves have escalated tensions between the world's two largest economies, which have failed to make a trade deal in more than 10 negotiating sessions. U.S. officials believe that the Chinese government could use Huawei telecom gear to spy or disrupt communications, and they have been lobbying allies to keep Huawei equipment out of their 5G network rollouts. Huawei has long denied that it would ever spy for the Chinese government and has challenged the U.S. to provide evidence that it is a threat. Okay, let's move on. I'm just sorting things out. I want to get in this editorial from the opinion page in the Wall Street Journal. Kamala Harris has a good health care idea, by John C. Goodman. As Democratic presidential candidates veer left to satisfy the party's radical base, it's easy to dismiss their ideas as a fantasy world, to quote Joe Biden. Even so, they occasionally have an idea worth considering. Consider Senator Kamala Harris's health care plan. She starts where Bernie Sanders does, with the goal of ending both employer-based insurance and private coverage in the Obamacare exchanges. And she corrals everyone into Medicare. So far, so radical. But unlike Mr. Sanders, she retains the Medicare Advantage program, under which more than a third of seniors enroll in private insurance. That's a big difference. Medicare for All is doomed for two reasons. First, working Americans are unlikely to support someone promising to eliminate the plan they get through work. Second, seniors are unlikely to support someone who wants to enroll more sick people in Medicare. That would threaten the solvency of the Medicare Trust Fund and force seniors to compete with younger patients for doctors and hospital beds. So if she gets the nomination, expect Ms. Harris, who has shown no reluctance to change her health policy ideas abruptly, to jettison these parts of her plan. Workers will keep their employer coverage. The elderly and the disabled will continue to have their separate coverage. Even without those features, Ms. Harris's plan calls for significant changes. She proposes to abolish the Obamacare exchanges, a signature Democratic accomplishment, and enroll participants in something resembling Medicare Advantage, a program expanded during the George W. Bush administration. The Medicare exchange for seniors is similar to the Obamacare exchange. But although it enrolls twice as many people and has been around much longer, you rarely see it discussed in the media. The reason? It works. The Obamacare exchanges have received so much attention because in many places they have been a disaster. Unlike Bernie Sanders, she would not abolish Medicare Advantage, the successful program for seniors. I'm going to read this particular sentence again. The Obamacare exchanges have received so much attention because in many places they have been a disaster. Enrollees in Medicare Advantage plans, by contrast, usually pay no more than their Part B premium. They get more benefits in return, and there are strict limits on out-of-pocket expenses. Medicare Advantage is also better than Obamacare. Government subsidies in the Obamacare exchanges are based on income, regardless of health condition. In Medicare Advantage, subsidies are based on health condition, regardless of income. That's why Medicare Advantage insurers compete to attract patients with costly health problems. In the Obamacare exchanges, by contrast, insurers seek to attract the healthy and avoid the sick. In 4 years, premiums have doubled and deductibles have tripled for people with Obamacare insurance. Worse, there has been a race to the bottom in terms of provider networks. Before Obamacare, patients who were uninsurable could often get risk pool insurance that looked like a regular Blue Cross employer plan. Under Obamacare, they too often find themselves in networks that pay Medicare rates and exclude the best doctors and hospitals. In Dallas, where I live, no plan in the individual market will give enrollees access to UT Southwestern Medical School, one of the world's best medical research facilities. As a Medicare Advantage enrollee, I have complete access to the facility and its physicians. Many Medicare Advantage plans are better even than typical employer plans. The best Medicare Advantage plans tend to be doctor-run organizations called independent practice associations, in which physicians coordinate their care. They strive to keep patients out of the hospital. They pay special attention to the chronically ill, who normally need care from several different specialists. The idea of replacing Obamacare exchanges with something similar to Medicare Advantage is better than anything Ms. Harris's Democratic rivals have proposed. It's also better than many Republican reform ideas, and it's better than most other existing forms of insurance. Medicare Advantage is much better than traditional Medicare. Ordinary Medicare is lousy insurance. Most Americans under 65 pay one premium to one plan. To get comparable coverage, seniors must pay three premiums to three plans. They get Part A hospital insurance free based on past payroll taxes, but they must pay a premium for Part B, doctor services, a second premium for Part D, drug coverage, and a third premium for Medigap insurance to fill the gaps that remain. Even after all that, most seniors still don't have the protection others have. Just about everybody in America with private Medicare Advantage isn't perfect. Regulation restricts the use of phone, email, Skype, and other forms of telemedicine. It also prevents access to concierge, direct primary care, doctors, who provide round-the-clock access and cost as little as $100 a month for senior patients, and there are no health savings accounts. Still, it beats Obamacare by a long shot. If Ms. Harris dropped her ambitions for banning private insurance, she would be on her way to a worthy health care plan. Okay, let's move on to this article in U.S. News. The headline reads, Wexner blames Epstein for missing funds, by Cadelia Safdar, S-A-F-D-A-R. Leslie Wexner, the billionaire behind Victoria's Secret, said his former money manager, Jeffrey Epstein, misappropriated more than $46 million of his fortune, revealing for the first time some of the financial fallout from his relationship with the disgraced financier. In a letter Wednesday, the founder and chief executive of L Brands Incorporated wrote to members of his Wexner Foundation that the missing funds were uncovered after Mr. Werner decided in 2007 to sever ties with Mr. Epstein. Mr. Wexner began the separation process after allegations against Mr. Epstein surfaced involving sexual abuse of underage girls. Quote, "We discovered that he had misappropriated vast sums of money from me and my family," unquote, Mr. Wexner wrote in the letter, which was reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Quote, "This was, frankly, a tremendous shock, even though it clearly pales in comparison to the unthinkable allegations against him now," unquote. In January 2008, Mr. Epstein transferred $46 million in investments to a Wexner charitable fund, tax records show. Mr. Wexner said the transfer was only a portion of the funds that his money manager had allegedly misappropriated. Quote, "All of that money, every dollar of it, was originally Wexner family money," unquote, he wrote. A lawyer for Mr. Epstein couldn't be reached for comment. A spokesman for Mr. Wexner declined to comment on whether Mr. Wexner reported the matter to authorities. Last month, Mr. Epstein pleaded not guilty to sex trafficking charges stemming from what federal prosecutors alleged was a years-long scheme to procure and sexually abuse dozens of girls. He faces up to 45 years in prison if convicted. Mr. Epstein has been denied bail and is in federal custody. Mr. Epstein's two-decade relationship with Mr. Wexner, which extended into the 81-year-old's retail companies, charities, and personal life, became crucial to Mr. Epstein's eventual wealth and prominence. In 1991, Mr. Wexner gave him sweeping control over his financial and legal matters through a power of attorney document. The Journal has reported that Mr. Epstein made more than $200 million from Mr. Wexner. In the letter, Mr. Wexner explained why he gave Mr. Epstein so much control. He wrote that several friends, quote, "vouched for and recommended him as a knowledgeable financial professional," unquote. He added that Mr. Epstein claimed he had many well-known clients. When allegations emerged against Mr. Epstein in Florida a decade ago, the money manager, quote, "vehemently denied," unquote, them, according to Mr. Wexner. Still, Mr. Wexner wrote that he decided in the fall of 2007 that Mr. Epstein should be removed from his role as personal money manager. The unwinding of their financial ties involved a legal intermediary. It was during this process, Mr. Werner said, that he discovered Mr. Epstein had misappropriated funds. Rabbi B. Elka Abrahamson, the Wexner Foundation's president, in a statement posted online last month, said the charity had received emails from its community voicing concerns about the relationship between Messrs. Wexner and Epstein. She said the foundation, like Mr. Wexner, had cut ties with him more than a decade ago and is, quote, sickened by Mr. Epstein's behavior, unquote. A representative for the Wexner Foundation, which focuses on the development of Jewish volunteer leaders and Israeli public officials, couldn't be reached for comment. The Journal has previously reported how Mr. Epstein became deeply entwined in the financial lives of his clients, who put him in charge of their charities, placed his name on deeds for their properties, and let him control their trusts. Quote, "I am embarrassed that, like so many others, I was deceived by Mr. Epstein," unquote, Mr. Wexner wrote Wednesday. Quote, "I know now that my trust in him was grossly misplaced and I deeply regret having ever crossed his path," unquote. Working in an office in Midtown Manhattan with a few lawyers, accountants, and administration staff, Mr. Epstein helped with the retail mogul's taxes, managed his investments, and ran his charities and trusts. He also became president of a company Mr. Wexner set up to develop the town where he lives near Columbus, Ohio. Until about 13 years ago, Mr. Epstein served on the board of several of Mr. Wexner's charities. Tax returns show. Okay. Let's continue. Let's go to U.S. Watch. Michigan State University, ex-Dean Strampel gets a year in jail. A judge sentenced former Michigan State University Dean William Strampel to 1 year in county jail as the impact of the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal continues to rock the university and its ex-employees. Dr. Strampel, who was dean of Michigan State's College of Osteopathic Medicine, was accused in March 2018 of soliciting sexual acts from students and of not supervising Nassar while the sports medicine doctor was under investigation for sexual misconduct. Scaled up. A python was displayed Wednesday as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis spoke of a larger effort to rid the Everglades of such snakes. Quote, "You could take the view that the risks now had gone up," unquote, and with an increased chance of a shock that could eventually prompt the Fed to return rates to near zero. Quote, "That would also call for more accommodation," unquote, Mr. Evans said. And with that, let's go back to the broadcast booth for a station break.
Sun Sounds is supported by Flood Control District of Maricopa County, encouraging families to develop a flood safety plan during Arizona monsoon to protect against flash flooding and hazardous driving conditions. More info at fcd.maricopa.gov.
Thank you. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona and KBAQ Phoenix HD3. Sun Sounds of Arizona's programming is primarily designed for and directed to people who cannot read conventional print due to a disability. Sun Sounds of Arizona is a public service of Rio Salado College. For more information, visit sunsounds.org.
Continuing now with reading from the Thursday, August 8th issue of the Wall Street Journal. Our reader today, Dr. Dick Lovins.
Okay, we have returned to the second portion of the program, which is entitled Business and Finance. And specifically, we are on the page called Heard on the Street, Financial Analysis and Commentary, which has a series of multi-columns. So, let's go to the first story. Few gains seen in merger. An analysis of United Technologies and Raytheon's patent portfolios confirms that the two companies have little in common. Aerospace company United Technologies and defense company Raytheon tout the advantages of combining their technological expertise through the mega merger they announced in June. A look at their patent portfolio suggests that any such gains will in fact be scant. That's scant, S-C-A-N-T. This week, hedge fund manager William Ackman said he had sold his stake in UTC. He and fellow activist Daniel Loeb have strongly opposed the deal, stating that it severely undervalues UTC by giving its shareholders only 57% of the new company's stock. While most valuation models suggest they are right, such numbers can always be debated. The deeper problem with the deal is that the strategic rationale is unclear, particularly as UTC is already dealing with the daunting task of spinning off its air conditioning and elevator divisions. Investors can't pin too much hope on the potential benefits of the two companies sharing technology. UTC would bring most of the tech to the table, even including its non-aerospace divisions. It owns a total of 17,682 patent families spread across all of its subsidiaries, compared with only 4,757 for Raytheon, according to data compiled by IFI Claims Patent Services, a provider of global patent databases. True, the IFI data shows a big overlap between the companies when it comes to communications, building radars, transmitters, satellite navigation systems, and the like. UTC could profit from Raytheon's wealth of expertise in processing sensor data, for example. But this is more the exception than the rule. In most technological areas, either UTC or Raytheon have more than 65% of the combined patents. When one firm already dominates, there is less to be gained by acquiring new patents. Indeed, when combining UTC and Raytheon, patents in overlapping areas make up only 15% of the combined total. This is a small figure compared with other hypothetical tie-ups. UTC and Rolls-Royce, for example, have a technological overlap of 57% by this measure, since both UTC's Pratt & Whitney division and the British manufacturer specialize in making jet engines. Such a merger would be ideal from a technological standpoint, The building blocks are the same, but each company focuses on a different market, narrow-body planes for P&W and wide-bodies for Rolls-Royce. Even Lockheed Martin, the biggest U.S. pure-play defense contractor by market value, would make for a better technological partner for UTC, Their patent overlap is 22%. And if Lockheed were to combine with Raytheon, another defense specialist, the figure goes up to 58%. It is precisely this lack of synergies that could smooth the proposed merger's path through the antitrust process. Regulators don't have a clear reason to block it, even though President Trump has expressed concern. Without a dividend from technology sharing, however, investors aren't left with a whole lot to like. We move to the right, and we read this short article, headlined, "Weakness in China's Dollar Empire, Here We Go." How should investors feel about the effect of the falling yuan on China's dollar debtors? It depends where you look and whom you believe. The most macro-level reading of China's national balance sheet is reassuring, The country has a positive net international investment position, simply meaning that it has more assets abroad than liabilities owed to foreigners. Bank for International Settlements data for the entire Chinese banking system, including the country's unlisted policy banks, also show more dollar assets than liabilities. But the full story is more complicated, China's four major commercial banks, which are also state-owned, no longer boast more dollar assets than liabilities. Bank of China, in particular, now owes a lot more in dollars than it is owed. The broader corporate sector also has binged on greenback bonds in recent years. According to analysts at Nomura, the amount of offshore dollar bonds issued by Chinese corporations has more than tripled since the end of 2014, rising to $841.6 billion at the end of June. Official figures show debt levels less than half of Nomura's estimate. Real estate development is the most vulnerable sector, with over $125 billion in bonds included in the ICE, that's ICE, the ICE Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. Let's read that sentence again. Real estate development is the most most vulnerable asset, with over $125 billion in bonds included in the ICE Bank of America Merrill Lynch Asian Dollar Index. That suggests that the sector accounts for roughly half of Asia's high-yield dollar bonds. The next most indebted Chinese sector is financial services, with less than half of that amount. Several developers have high levels of dollar debt, according to research by Singapore's DBS Bank. Large developers, including Central China Real Estate, Modern Land, and Fantasia, have non-yuan debts that ran to more than 80% of their total equity at the end of 2018. Kaisa, K-A-I-S-A, a large real estate company that defaulted on offshore bonds in 2015, but has since managed to return to dollar debt markets, has a ratio of more than 100%. The companies, that's companies, apostrophe, the company's stock prices are, understandably, highly sensitive to movements in the yuan. The question of how dangerous those exposures are comes back to two common questions in Chinese finance, Who gets the backing of the state And are Chinese statistics accurate? If the figures that the government reports to the BIS are accurate, then China could afford to cover even the most over-leveraged developers. If they aren't, or Beijing isn't minded to help out, then a depreciation combined with a slowing housing market could send some to the wall. The housing market is the cornerstone of Chinese household wealth and the source of a great deal of the country's economic activity. A threat to that foundation could ripple through the country's financial system if Beijing doesn't or can't defend it. Okay. Let's read this article. Hedge funds and retailers don't mix. Barney's New York owner, Richard Perry, isn't the only deep-pocketed money manager to watch over the decline of a storied retailer. Investors from Eddie Lampert, once lauded as the next Warren Buffett to Bill Ackman, have taken on clothing chains only to walk away with their wallets and reputations in tatters. The retailers' fates might not have otherwise been any different, but the managers could have done without the experience. Barney's filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection Tuesday morning with a financing package in place that closes the majority of its stores. The loan should give the retailer 2 months to find a buyer or liquidate. Mr. Perry's hedge fund, Perry Capital, is the controlling shareholder. Perry Capital was once a force in the hedge fund world. At its height in 2007, the firm had $15 billion under management. The fund first invested in Barney's in 2009, snapping up $200 million in distressed bank debt. But Perry Capital closed in 2016 after losses and investor redemptions. Barney's was one of the few assets it had left. Barney's was a relatively small chain worth just $942 million when Istithmar World, the investment arm of state-owned Dubai World, bought it in 2007. Mr. Lampert's sad run with Sears was more spectacular. At its peak in 2006, a year after Mr. Lampert took control by merging Kmart and Sears, the company operated more than 2,300 stores. It entered court protection last year with fewer than 700. Then there is Mr. Ackman, whose investment in JCPenney cost his fund more than $600 million by the time he sold it in 2013, while the retailer shed thousands of employees. He recruited Ron Johnson, who had run Apple's retail chain, to reinvent the chain and the American department store. Mr. Johnson instead presided over a collapse in sales and was replaced by the man who Mr. Ackman had pushed out. The activist also suffered defeats at bookseller Borders and retail giant Target. Perry Capital was also a large investor in T.C. Penney, close paren. Retail disasters are by no means unique to the hedge fund world. The managers of private equity firms KKB and Bain forked over $20 million last year to assist thousands of workers at Toys R Us left jobless after the buyout firm's more than 10-year reign ended with a thud. The buyout business is littered with other examples of retailer bankruptcies and restructurings, including Claire's Stores and J. Crew, C-R-E-W. Turnarounds are tough to get right, but the stain on the track records of the masters of the universe is noteworthy. Some hedge fund managers reckoned that their stock picking ability would translate into management insight. The retail industry proved as much a blow to their egos as to their net worth. Okay. Let's turn the page. And read Wednesday's markets. The headline says, "Taste for fast food shares increases," by Murdy Nzanga, N-Z-A-N-G-A, and here we go. Investors haven't lost their appetite for fast casual dining stocks. Wendy's company was one of the latest fast food stocks to jump, gaining 8.2% Wednesday after it reported a same-store sales increase of 1.4% for the second quarter. On Tuesday, rival Shake Shack Incorporated closed at $86.72 and rose $13.38, or 18%, for its best daily percentage gain on record, according to FactSet data. Yum Brands Incorporated reached an intraday high of $119.72 last week. Shares of the company, which owns KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, are up 26% so far this year. On Wednesday, Shake Shack fell 1.7% and Yum Brands was up 0.2%. Shares of the fast casual dining sector have been strong performers among consumer discretionary stocks. The sector closed up 0.31% Wednesday amid a broader market decline and has posted an 18.2% gain since the start of the year. Shares of these chains are traditionally seen as defensive, analysts say, People still go out for fast food even if the economy slows. In addition, they are seen as attractive because some are offering healthier options and technology that makes it easier for customers to place orders. Quote, "The earning growth rates could slow, but these chains could do better than full, but these chains could do better than full food service," unquote, said Eric Gonzalez, a senior restaurant analyst with KeyBank Capital Markets. Mexican food chain Chipotle Mexican Grill Incorporated has been a leader, with its stock price up 84% since the beginning of the year. One reason for its success, analysts say, is its use of third-party carriers, such as DoorDash Incorporated, and its mobile app. It has doubled its digital sales for this quarter compared with a year earlier. McDonald's Corporation, too, has remained an investor favorite. The chain's shares are up 22% this year. It has taken steps to reinvent its food quality, now using all white meat chicken, for example. In addition, it has incorporated technology for customers, such as touchscreen self-ordering kiosks. McDonald's has a large international presence, which could hedge it against slowing growth in the U.S. Yum Brands, too, has outlets overseas. Quote, "Broadly speaking, international exposure can be a benefit for particular fast food restaurant stocks," unquote, said Mr. Gonzalez. A Chipotle spokeswoman said the company is focused on the U.S. Quote, we plan to open 140 to 155 new locations this year and believe that there is still tremendous runway for a larger domestic footprint before settling our sights abroad, she said. Okay. Let's read this article. Oil extends slide as inventories rise, by Amrith Ramkumar and Ann David Hodari. I have just been presented today's results on Wall Street, so let's take a moment off this article and read them. The market report for August 8, 2019, the Dow Jones averages at 26,319.96, up 312.35. NASDAQ Composite is 8,011.69, up 148.63. S&P 500 is at 2,930.41, up 46.43. So, we were talking about commodities. Let's start again. Oil extends slide as inventories rise, by Amrith Ramkumar and David Hodari. Here we go. A rout in oil prices deepened Wednesday after government data showed an unexpected increase in stockpiles, triggering fresh worries that demand for fuel is weakening alongside the U.S. economy. U.S. crude futures fell 4.7% to $51 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange, their lowest close since mid-January. They have dropped 13% in August, their worst start in a month in 4 years, according to Dow Jones market data. Brent crude, the global gauge of prices, declined 4.6% to $56.23 a barrel on the Intercontinental Exchange. The move comes a day after Brent joined U.S. crude in bear market territory, down more than 20% from its year-to-date peak. The slide in oil highlights the anxiety about the world economy that continues to jolt financial markets. U.S. crude tumbled nearly 8% in a single session last week after President Trump announced fresh tariffs on about $300 billion of Chinese imports, spurring worries that consumers will limit spending and economic growth will stagnate. Quote, the oil market is telling us the uncertainty here is significantly higher than several weeks ago, unquote, said Rob Thummel, senior portfolio manager for Tortoise Capital Advisors. Quote, investors are looking for ways to take risk off the table, unquote. Those fears were reflected in the latest Energy Information Administration crude inventory data, which showed stockpiles rose 2.4 million barrels last week. They stand 2% above their five-year average for this time of year, indicating that there is plenty of oil available. Analysts and traders surveyed by the Wall Street Journal had expected inventories to fall 2.8 million barrels. A drop in U.S. crude exports also raised anxiety about weakening consumption. Quote, it's a combination of the same factors weighing on prices in recent days, colon. Trade war concerns, less economic growth, less oil demand growth, and on top of that, today we've had EIA data that are bearish and certainly not helping matters, unquote, said Giovanni Staunovo, a commodity analyst at UBS Wealth Management. The rise in oil stockpiles for the week ended August 2nd ended a streak of seven consecutive weekly declines that had helped support crude despite oversupply worries. Stockpiles tend to drop in the summer amid healthy demand during the summer driving season, so some analysts are wary of more bearish increases moving forward. An inventory rise earlier in the year helped send West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. oil price benchmark, into a bear market in early June. It has been in a bear market for 2 months. Although prices are still up solidly in 2019, they are down about 25% in the past 12 months, a boon for U.S. consumers who are paying less on average for gasoline this summer. Okay. Let's move on. To World Watch. Islamic State groups resurgence tied to U.S. policies. Islamic State militants are strengthening their capability to carry out insurgent attacks in Iraq and Syria, according to a new report to Congress by the Pentagon's Office of Inspector General that in part links Trump's administration policy decisions to signs of a resurgence. The extremist group's determination to make a comeback and the difficulties encountered by the U.S.-backed Iraqi and Syrian forces in holding ground in remote areas have provided a fresh opening for the militants, the report says. Decisions by the Trump administration to reduce U.S. forces in Syria, shrink the American diplomatic presence in Iraq, and divert reconnaissance systems to efforts to monitor Iranian activity in the region also have worked to Islamic State's benefit, it says. And with that, we've completed our program for today. I wish you a great remainder of the day, and it will be my great pleasure to welcome you to this program next Thursday at the same time, reading the Wall Street Journal. Bye-bye.